Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Don't call it a comeback. We'll actually do, because we are back with part two on the weird, weird, weird history of shipping things in the U.S. If you have not listened to part one, for your sake, we're just looking out for you, go ahead and pause this and go play part one. It's worth it.
We'll wait. I'm Noel, by the way.
Oh, that's right. And I am Ben Bolin. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Casey Pegram. And we are officially halfway through the very strange story of how things get from point A to point B and all the weird stops they make along the way.
So how about we join that already in progress?
The way that Atlas Obscura phrases it is pretty funny. The author says the owners of the Central Pacific Railroad created a company solely for the purpose of screwing with Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
Which I always love it when people interject a little bit of petty humanity into these stories.
Oh, this story is full of petty humanity for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've all had to ship something somewhere. So you're right. They do decide to purchase this company, and they continue being this huge force in the package industry until World War I, because during World War I, the U.S. government forces all of these postage services, all the express industry companies, to combine into a single monolithic thing, and they nationalize it, and they call this the Railway Express Agency.
Yeah, and this is specifically so the government can have an easier time of shipping wartime necessities, such as rations, human beings, and all of the other trappings and accoutrements of war. And as we know in history, all good things must come to an end, and disruptive technology is just the order of the day. And in 1975, this monolith collapsed as well, and it's because of motor vehicles. They just became much more efficient for shipping things because you weren't bound to literal routes laid out on tracks, and you could just be a lot more nimble in shipping stuff. And that's when we start to see Wells Fargo completely abandoning shipping and receiving in favor of exclusively their banking operations, which, again, they were happening in tandem. The banks were kind of part and parcel, if you'll excuse the pun, you don't have to the shipping business. Because of the fact they were already handling these assets, it made sense for them to be able to just invest them and hold them for people in all of these various Wells Fargo locations. So they give that up, and this is when we start to see a lot more individual companies pop up, startup companies at the time, for lack of a better term, like UPS and FedEx.
Yeah, we have to remember that while all these swells and shipping tycoons were putting their stamp on history, we have to remember that the federal post office at this time was a lot more like a regulatory agency than something that actually shipped packages and letters. So while all this is happening, and let's jump back in time here, in the early days of the federal post office, it wasn't a shipping company. It was more of a regulatory agency. They made rules about how packages and letters should be sent. Until, that is, several big changes occur, which lead us to the current day. The first was the Rural Free Delivery Act, or the establishment of rural free delivery in 1896. This was huge for more than half of the country, because half of the country lived in rural areas, and now they could get mail directly sent to them instead of having to go to, the county seat to find the post office. And in 1913, there was another big change. It was something called parcel post.
Yeah, parcel post, just to send, I mean, it's as simple as it became much more cost effective to ship things maxing out at 50 pounds at the time. In fact, it was so efficient that, as is referenced in this Atlas Obscura article, college students would ship their dirty laundry home in these specially made metal boxes so their parents could do their laundry for them and then ship it back. And it was more cost effective to do that than to go to a laundromat or hire somebody to wash their clothes for them.
Which is crazy, right? You have to wonder, was the mail just that cheap, or were laundromats themselves incredibly expensive? There's so much weird stuff that's been mailed over the years. We can laundry list a few toward the end, but we should mention, just an honorable mention, of course, to Charlotte Mae Pierstorf, who was literally mailed from Grangeville to Lewiston, Idaho, for about 53 cents. Her trip only took a few hours. This was legal at the time because she was under the weight limit.
I hope they poked some holes in the box for her.
She did make it. She did survive. Yeah. So maybe she was practicing some sort of deep meditation to restrict her breathing. I don't know.
You ever seen that Malcolm in the Middle episode where the older brother, whose name I'm forgetting, what's his name? It doesn't matter. He wants to ship himself to China because he wants to beat up his pen pal for some reason. And Dewey, the very smart younger brother, decides to help him and also screw with him by packing him up into a giant wooden crate and then simulating what it would feel like to make that journey by, like, you know, rocking it back and forth and having sound effects. And he even had like a fish out so it smelled like the sea and all this stuff. And he's got, like, you know, boxes of cereal and like milk and stuff inside the crate. I just love the idea of anyone shipping themselves somewhere as a substitute to other more traditional forms of travel.
And shout out, of course, to Henry Box Brown. I know a lot of our fellow listeners are waiting to at least have a mention of this brilliant man who escaped slavery when he was 33 by having himself mailed in 1849 to Philadelphia, which is, talk about out-of-the-box thinking. Well, the out-of-the-box thinking led him into a box, and then he got out of the box.
He eventually did get out of the box. That's true. Yeah, that's a really cool story. And there's an episode of Stuff You Missed in History Class on that very subject.
Mm-hmm. So let's bring ourselves forward to the future. You mentioned UPS earlier. They started out in Seattle in 1907 as the American Messenger Company, or AMC, with no affiliation to the theater company now. This was kind of like a gig economy. There were a bunch of kids who weren't full-time employees. They were just doing odd jobs for not a ton of money.
Remember the episode we did about the Firefly Catchers?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it was that company that, what was the company? It was like a chemical company that, like, literally crowdsourced little kids to go around catching fireflies. This was like that on a smaller scale initially, which is crazy considering, you know, the corporate megalith this eventually became. But yeah, they describe it here as almost like a lemonade stand mentality. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it ballooned when this young man at the age of 19, James Casey, expanded, and he started kind of combining the efforts of all of these little disparate gig kind of courier services and moved outside of Seattle and then changed the company to United Parcel Service in 1919. And their big thing was using cars. Like we said, it was much more nimble. They were very good at planning these routes and making things as efficient as possible.
Yeah, and at this time, UPS experiences tremendous growth, thanks, of course, to the boom of the automobile industry. It also naturally becomes a direct competitor to this parcel post system because UPS gets something called common carrier rights. Common carrier rights mean that shipping companies like UPS have some of the rights and responsibilities of a public company or state service, even though it's a private entity. Because it's explicitly working for the general public good, it is subject to regulation by the government. This sounds like a bunch of red tape, but ultimately what it allows UPS to do is to become, at the time, the biggest package shipper in the world. And they are, of course, still overland shipping. There's no airmail yet, although some folks tried, right? I think The U.S. government actually tried airmail a couple of times. The POD, the Post Office Department, started delivering mail by aircraft in 1918, but they couldn't, you know, they couldn't deliver packages, just letters, just very fancy letters.
And that list included, we had the newly established United States Postal Service, which, as we mentioned at the top of the show, went from being a more of a department to an actual agency. They have the letter delivery situation on lock. No one else really needs to mess with that. It's not really an area of concern for any of these other companies. We have UPS. And then in 1971, we have Federal Express, which the seed of that idea began in a Yale dorm room in 1965. It was a dream, and the subject of a term paper by undergraduate Frederick W. Smith, who essentially invented the idea of airmail in this paper that didn't even get a particularly good grade. His professor did not see the value in this revolutionary idea, and he didn't flunk it, but it sounded like he gave it more of a C. So then in 71, after a little bit of time spent in the military, Smith got out of his service, and he bought a very large share, controlling share, in an Arkansas company called Arkansas Aviation Sales, which is in Little Rock. And he began to see how tough the logistical side of using airplanes to deliver freight in a timely manner. So he decided that he was going to find a better way to do that using kind of the lessons he learned from that term paper.
Right. So Fred Smith is pretty candid with himself and the employees of Arkansas Aviation Sales about the difficulties facing their company. And I got to say, I appreciate that FedEx's official website is also very honest about the bumps and obstacles in the way. That's where we're getting a lot of this history here. He is behaving exactly like all those people you see at the beginning of made-for-TV infomercials where something happens, they kind of bumble something, and they go, there's got to be a better way. And that is where he gets the idea for Federal Express, because going back to the paper, which was still very prescient, he thinks there are two big challenges, logistics and then infrastructure, right, which are inextricably intertwined. So he chooses the name Federal Express for some pretty clever reasons. Said federal makes it sound, you know, more like a government entity.
And like patriotic, too. You wanted to appeal to people's patriotism and the idea that, I think, the Federalist Papers was a big part of the foundation of our country, and there would be positive associations with that.
Yeah, he thinks it'll help attract public attention. It also helps him with one of his first potential clients, the Federal Reserve Bank. He thought they're going to love this. They turned it down. But obviously, FedEx soldiered on. They moved to Memphis, Tennessee, because it was kind of central in the U.S. And the airport was in a great location, was rarely closed due to bad weather. They were also able, they said, look, hey, guys, if you want to move FedEx here, we will work with you.
Yeah, and again, that goes into his forward thinking as far as like streamlining the process and the logistics. So they began operations on April 17th in 1973. And according to their official website, they had 389 employees and 14 planes that were housed in hangars there at the Memphis airport. And on their first outing, they delivered 186 packages to 25 states, Rochester, New York, to Miami, Florida, and all points in between. And much like the Pony Express, they were not profitable at first, but unlike the Pony Express, they did figure out how to soldier through. And from 1973 to 1975, no profits. But then in July of 1975, it started becoming a very prominent carrier of luxury goods in the marketplace, and it started to become this kind of bellwether of how to do business shipping things in this kind of new era of on-demand door-to-door shipment.
This path ultimately leads FedEx to become the world's largest all-cargo air fleet. They have tons of planes thanks to deregulation. And in 1983, they were the first American company to get $1 billion worth of revenue within 10 years of a startup without being bought by anybody and without merging. So they got there on their own in that business sense. And this still, despite the company's size, is just a small piece of the weird, weird, gigantic thing we call the shipping industry. We didn't even get into cargo ships. I want everybody listening to know, if you want a weird vacation, you can actually book a ride on a cargo ship. Yeah, you just have to be very flexible with your times.
Is it like cost effective?
I mean,
or is this more like a weird vacation?
It's like it's a weird vacation. It's a slow boat across the ocean.
So I wouldn't like book myself passage on a cargo ship to save money.
Maybe you could, depending. You know, it's so different because it's going to take such a long time. You might have to. You can say, okay, I want to arrive, you know, X amount of months or days later in East Asia, but they'll say, okay, well, give it a margin of error of a month or two.
Oh, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. And we mentioned this briefly at the top of the show, but like where things are now, it's interesting how it's come full circle. Now, shipping and receiving is becoming much more back to those old days of just kind of getting a courier, like with like a TaskRabbit person or using Uber in some places, like in New York, Uber drivers will pick up and bring you stuff, you know, like if they're not supposed to, but they will. And then you have other delivery, you know, on-demand services like Zifty and what have you. And I feel like we've kind of come back full circle, not to mention the elephant in the room, the giant elephant in the room, which is Amazon in terms of how potentially they stand to dominate shipping and receiving through their Amazon Prime memberships, et cetera. You know, like, I mean, they have all these fulfillment centers that are nearby. So when you order goods, you're not having to have it shipped from across the country. You literally have a duplicate facility that's much more close to you that you could get your whatever it is, your, you know, Pikachu keychain, you know, in the same day, because it's literally just a local delivery person bringing it from that fulfillment center that might only be an hour or even less away from you if you live in a bigger city like New York. So it's interesting to see how that's going to develop as they start, you know, experimenting with terrifying things like using drones to deliver birthday cakes and whatnot.
And now we've caught up to the current situation. We also want to give an honorable mention to several strange things that have been shipped in the past. Of course, diseases have been shipped.
Accidentally, I would assume.
Well, there's a lady named Miss Daisy James in a August 7th, 1895 issue of the New York Times who said that dead birds and small animals are sent to taxidermists throughout the country. She also handled different strains of smallpox, diphtheria, and scarlet fever that were shipped by doctors to the health board.
Remember when people were sending anthrax in the mail a lot? That was a thing.
Mm-hmm. Or fake anthrax as well.
Right.
There have also been entire buildings shipped, sometimes brick by brick. Pets, of course, loose diamonds, which are, you know, the millionaire's go-to escape plan. And many, many other strange things. One thing that might be of interest to some of us is that you can ship things anonymously through the mail. These can range from practical jokes to just very weird stuff.
Or contraband, perhaps,
which we are not, we're not condoning, right? On a family show.
But what happens to the recipient? I mean, sure, you can send something anonymously, but the person that receives it could then be on the hook for whatever you sent. How does that work?
Well, there's a neat article on cheatsheet.com where it says it lists some different entities that will help you send weird stuff. You can send somebody a potato in the mail. You can send them a glitter bomb, which is crazy.
Really, really horrible.
Yeah, I would not do that to someone, and please don't do that to
me. It just gets in every orifice.
It's been described as, of course, the herpes of the craft world.
That's very true.
You can ship a brick. You can send people fake money. You can send them a gigantic teddy bear, a Venus flytrap, just some sand. One of the weirdest things, a lot of these are jokes and strange pranks. You can send prank candles that smell good when they burn for the first few minutes, and then they go from like vanilla to, you know, sulfur or fecal smell.
Farts.
Yeah. And then you can send the worst cup of coffee. You can send an eggplant. Some things like that. Like I think potatoes and coconuts, you don't even have to wrap. You can just put a stamp on them.
I do love a good mail order coconut.
That's the way I often prefer them. And this brings us to you, dear listeners. What are some of the weirdest things that you have ever encountered via parcel or post? What's the weirdest thing you've ever delivered or had delivered to you? We want to know. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter, not just as Ridiculous History, but as individuals as well.
You can find me exclusively on Instagram, where I go by the handle at HowNowNoelBrown.
You can find me on Twitter at BenBolinHSW for the old school How Stuff Works fans out there. You can also find me on Instagram in various adventures, where I am at BenBolin. Thanks, as always, to super producer Casey Pegram.
Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Research associate Gabe Luzier. Christopher Hasiotis, here in spirit.
Eve's Jeffcoat, of course, the Quizster, a.k.a. Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. Young Quizzles, a.k.a. ASAP Quizzy.
A.k.a. The Worst. Oh, and hey, do us a solid, and why don't you go over to iTunes or your podcast platform of choice and leave us a nice review or a really hilarious bad review. We might read it on the show one day. And if you don't want to do any of that stuff, you can send us an email where we are ridiculous@iheartradio.com.
The check's in the mail, folks. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you soon.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.